First of all, as I said, I want to introduce myself as the co-chair of State Watch. We have our 20th anniversary conference on June the 25th of this year. And State Watch started off very much probably in the same kind of tradition as the No Borders and all the NGOs working in this field. For the last 20 years, it's been essentially three or four people working part-time on absolute minimum wages with absolute dedication to produce all this information that is used by people all over Europe, all over the world. And we're very proud to have a 20-year conference which now reflects the fact that we have a network across Europe of contributors. We have a very successful website which has been described as the most reliable source on justice and home affairs in the EU, not only by NGOs, but also by a man who used to be in charge of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Lord Jay, told me that this is the only reliable source on justice and home affairs in the European Union. Now bear in mind, that's a man who had at his hands the MI6, MI5, or the Foreign Office Intelligence. But State Watch is assiduous in getting hold of the latest documents and explaining and contextualising what is happening in European Union policy. That's one of the points I want to make in my talk, that it's very important that when we're looking at what's happening in the UK, we need to understand where that fits into European Union policy and the role of the UK in helping to develop this EU policy. So I'm going to pass round the conference programme. And please encourage you all to come, and please register. If you want to come, register as soon as possible, because the last one we had, a 10-year conference, was well oversubscribed, so you're all very welcome. The programme for that day, I'll just do a little bit more of a talk about that, reflects the reason why we've seen migration as being at the core of understanding what's happening with civil liberties in the European Union, for everyone, migrants and non-migrants. First of all, in the opening plenary session, we have Gareth Pearce talking about the war on terror. Gareth Pearce has worked, as many of you will know, on issues in Ireland and the treatment of Irish people in the UK, and the way in which the war on terror and the treatment of people defined as terrorists has undermined civil liberties and the rule of law, again, the very opposite of what was supposedly intended in the UK. Francis Weber, Nadine Finch and Vasilis Karidis and Migri Europe talking about Fortress Europe, particularly immigration, asylum and border controls. And then we have workshops also on mass surveillance and the technologies of control and the Stockholm Programme and the post-Lisbon European Union. These will explain and go into detail about the impact of EU policy on migration and asylum and the importance of knowing what's happening under the current Stockholm programme and the implications this will have for everybody's rights. In the afternoon, we have workshops on criminalising communities and the policing of protest, on racism, Islamophobia and the far right, and a workshop on defending civil liberties, strategies of resistance, and the final plenary about chartering the terrain and what we see might be happening in the decade ahead. So the involvement of people on the ground, activist groups, is very important to this conference, and I'd be very glad to see any of you there. I want to start my talk by addressing this question of who is a migrant. Because when we're looking at borders, the whole thing about borders is somehow about controlling the movements of people defined as migrants. And basically, I worry, although my professional life involves teaching students, undergraduate and postgraduate students, about migration and migration policy, I worry sometimes that we use this term migrant as a shorthand for describing a whole human being. Now, who is a migrant? Being a migrant is only one aspect of somebody's life. And in many ways, all of us are migrants. It depends how recently you want to describe migration has been one aspect of your life. So everybody in this room has a migrant background. Everybody living in the United Kingdom has a migrant background. We all didn't, our generations ago, our ancestors didn't come from this part of the world. So we need to be careful about that terminology. So in a way, who is a migrant means it's all of us. So we're all human beings. And when we enter into the political debate about migration, in some ways we're subscribing to this kind of bogeyman image set up by the media, using the term migrant throws into people's heads a racialized notion of somebody who may be vulnerable but blamed for their vulnerability, may be victimized and blamed for being a victim, all those things about that we used to talk about, the welfare state, the benefits scroungers, it's all of those, it mirrors all of those kind of definitions. And people try to say, oh well, we don't mind this kind of migrant, but we don't like that kind of migrant. And it's like the respectable poor and the criminal classes, how the poor used to be described, and now all that discourse is coming back again. The bogeyman image sells papers, and it also gets the governments elected, gets parties elected into government. So this image is used up and conjured up for all those kind of commercial or political purposes. And I think we should go back to saying, being a migrant, either we're going to say we're all migrants or we're all human beings, and stop having this discourse where we say, well, actually, there's these people who are us, and then these other people, and for some reason we have to call, they're called migrants. And I think the problem is when we try to defend, change the terms of the debate, we have to use those terms in challenging them. So that's really hard conceptually to get our heads around. And I run classes and have students coming out with certificates and degrees in this subject. So in a way, I'm kind of criticising my own actions in this. Yeah. But I don't see how else that I can teach on a topic and attract people to come and study. But this is the kind of thing that I raise with the students all the time. I think it's important that we remember that rights may be defined by citizenship, but in actual fact, in law and in migration policy law, they really citizenship only is one aspect of all of this. And Bridget's much more of an expert than I am on that whole debate. But there's a difference between what happens in policy and law and what happens in reality. And in reality, it involves negotiating paperwork, having access to lawyers, financial issues, having funding. So in a way, it depends who you are, not just what your citizenship or your legal status is. So how does this relate to the UK and the European Union? Well, in EU policy, it is writ large in all the documents that have come out ever since the Amsterdam Treaty, in all the programmes on migration and immigration and asylum policy, up to the recent one, but it's especially noticeable in the last five-year programme, the Hague programme, about this reduction of a human being to being one aspect of their life, being a migrant. And I saw, working in Brussels and Luxembourg, I saw the discourse change. The terminology changed. We used to talk about international migration, and it meant everybody. Everybody in the EU moving in and out of what, from one member state to another member state. Everybody moving from outside the European Union into the European Union. It was much more a debate that was discussed in terms of the kind of language that demographers and geographers and social scientists would use. And I worked on the statistical database of the EU, so that when they were trying to decide how many people were coming in and out, how should we count, and all of those issues. This is 20 years ago. The debate changed, especially as policy hardened, and this is linked to the point about Europe moving to the right, the governments moving to the right. So it became a situation where we no longer, we were asked not to use the term migrants about EU citizens. We were told now all movement of EU citizens within the European Union is internal migration. And international migration is of non-EU citizens coming into the EU. And then it changed again, and we were told, right, when you're writing policy documents, use the term migrant. It only ever refers to a non-EU citizen moving into the EU. So the legal definitions, the policy terms used in the European Union were changing the whole definition of who is a migrant. It was changing the meaning of borders within the EU from international borders to internal borders. But of course, that all depends on who you are. I mean, for people now coming from Libya, the so-called internal border of the EU between Italy and France is very much an international border. If you're a citizen of either of Libya or further south in Africa, but if you're a French citizen or an Italian citizen, it's still an internal, virtually doesn't exist. You're an Italian-French person can move freely across that border. So what's important there is to remember that where the European project came from really was from an economic project, and the main emphasis was on the free movement of goods and capital, as you were saying, free movement across to create a market. That's why it was called the common market. Free movement of people was always there somewhere as a vague idea, and it's come about more, it's been more exercised now. But what we still have is a case now where even for EU citizens, we might have freedom of movement for EU citizens, the right to move across a border, but we still don't have the right of residence in another EU. You still have to ask permission to live in another EU country. You still have to claim rights to welfare rights, and this is absolutely crucial. As Bridget was saying, it's the transferability of welfare rights from one country to another, the right of access to welfare benefits in another country. Although I have lived part of the time in Luxembourg and Brussels, and I have a Belgian residence card, I don't have transferability of pension rights, of welfare rights. If I'm sick in Belgium when I'm there, I go to the hospital and I pay cash. And then if I'm lucky, I come back here and claim it back. I have to go wade through a whole load of bureaucracy. We still have those barriers for citizens of the EU. So we have all that going on. And then at the same time, we have this idea that we've got some common external frontier of the European Union. And this all the member states have cooperated together to create a so-called safe border at the external geographical exterior of the EU. And what I'd like to question here is whether the idea that we can move beyond borders is going to be very difficult, because the actual border of the European Union, it may appear to be at this geographical frontier of the member states, but in fact it already exists in the middle of Africa. It exists in Pacific countries, it exists in the Caribbean, because Europe's borders are being policed all over the world. So how we get beyond that border when it is already gone beyond, far beyond what we imagined, people imagine it to be, is a big problem. So we have the externalisation of borders, externalisation of border controls, and at the same time we have the internalisation of borders and border controls, where the internalisation, where it now is in our minds, no matter how much we resist it. In the universities we are asked to police our students. Well, we're required to do it, and I resist, but we're required to check visas, to check people's passports, to become effectively UK border agents in some way. Now, I resist that, I challenge it at every opportunity, but it creeps in through the bureaucracy, in the paperwork. We're asked to tick a form. Have you checked the passport? Have you seen the student recently? Now, is this student in good standing? The universities have overinterpreted the guidance from the UK Border Agency on how to police the points-based system, and they have been instructing academic staff and administrative staff to police students in a way that was never envisaged even by the UK Border Agency. So there's a big problem there about externalisation and internalisation of border controls. For the European Union, what we can see in the last two or three weeks, the last month or so, of what's been happening between Libya and Italy, that is really brings home, really in many ways, the moral bankruptcy of the European Union's policies on migration. Because Libya was being effectively paid by the Italian state to police migration coming from Africa and intended migrants coming into Italy, to the tune of, first of all, 250 million euros a year. This has been documented by Migri Europe in their last report, November 2010. So I recommend, if you want to look in the detail of this, look on their website, and that annual report, that second annual report, is absolutely crucial on this issue. Colonel Gaddafi went to Italy and said, okay, let's do a deal. I'll set up detention camps in Libya if you pay me this amount of money. And he kept demanding more and more money, millions and then billions of pounds, of euros. So the Italian politicians and the right-wing Italian politicians in the north of Italy could argue, well, we've solved the problem of immigration and the island of Lampedusa. We don't have illegal migrants coming across the Mediterranean anymore. But all these people who would have ended up in Lampedusa were being held in detention centres in Libya. And the reason why migrants have suddenly appeared back in Italy and trying to get through to France, and the Italian government is using this as a political point scoring issue, is because Gaddafi said, okay, if you're bombing me, why should I be policing your borders? So that shows the moral bankruptcy of the so-called ethical, there was no ethical migration policy. There was no attempt really to help the potential migrants, to give them an alternative life, to check the humanitarian conditions in those camps in Libya. In fact, the EU was providing funds to build an electronic fence across the middle of Libya to stop sub-Saharan African migrants coming into Libya. So the EU, at the same time as giving the citizens all this ideal stuff about fundamental rights and a fair immigration policy, at the same time was funding the very man they call the despot now to police the most vulnerable people on behalf of the EU in an invisible way. So that's one of the things that I've been very angry about. Another thing is the activities of Frontex. And Frontex is the EU's so-called border agency, which has been acting in a way to take more and more powers on itself beyond its remit. It's supposed to be an agency of the European Commission. It's become, in a way, a monster that has defined its own powers. And it's trying now to take on powers that a member state would choose for itself, to say, well, we'll decide what is a secret document. If we've got a policy or we've got a plan of action, we're going to decide whether it can be made public or not. This is actually against the treaties. It's against the treaty base of the European Union. So in Statewatch and in other NGOs are challenging this this power that Frontex is taking on to itself. But the most really pernicious thing that's happening now is Frontex's policing of the Mediterranean with the basically military-style boats, creating a border through the middle of the Mediterranean. And somebody mentioned Lesbos. I was in Lesbos last summer and saw, I met people there who witnessed the Frontex boats effectively turning over migrant boats in the water by going towards them and then turning quickly and then creating a wave so the boat turns over, and then rescuing some people and sometimes towing the boat without its oars back to Turkey, putting vulnerable people in the water, including pregnant women, and all sorts of horrific things happening there. But the thing, obviously there's the fundamental rights issue there. The thing that's happening is the EU's physically external it's policing, it's the border within the Mediterranean, potentially, possibly in an illegal way, because it has, it's not meeting its duties on the, in the law of the sea to rescue people. But also, it seems to have taken the choice to externalise the policing of the border, but not externalise fundamental rights. So it can say, right, we're on behalf of the EU, we're going to police this stretch of water, but you won't have the right to claim asylum if we take you on our boat. So we don't have to take you into European Union territory, we're just going to return you back to the country that you set off from. Now, there's no basis in international law for these actions. And as a result of these activities, the Mediterranean is becoming a site of death. People see the Mediterranean as a place to fear now. It's a place they try to get across, and they try to go to make a better life. Instead of being seen, if you didn't have all of that, it could have been like in the days of empire, wouldn't want to go back to that, but an area of trade where people crossed freely across the water, where exchange went on, where human beings moved around. It would be seen as a kind of transport system. Now it's just seen as a wall of death, really. So there's a problem there. There's a problem about what EU borders mean. That it means something different depending on who you are, where you are. Depends on whether you're on the territory, geographical territory of the EU, or whether you're somebody outside, either in the Mediterranean or in an African country, or even at the other side of the world. Where it's in the Migra Europe report, there's even a report of people being arrested in Mauritania because they look as though, or they think that somebody thinks that the police think that they might want to go to Europe. And one person was arrested for wearing a Barcelona football club t-shirt because he thought, oh, he's potentially going to try and get him to go and see Barcelona. It's the criminalisation of thought, not just what you actually think, but what somebody thinks you think. So that's some of the consequences for the rights and civil liberties of people outside the EU. One of the things we try to do in State Watch is to say we need to rethink how civil liberties should be seen, and if you don't defend the rights of people defined as migrants, then the rights of everybody are going to be undermined. So we need to stop all these dichotomies between who's a migrant, who's not a migrant. And one of the biggest dangers now that's happened as a result of the securitisation of migration control, of all this emphasis on fear and externalisation of control, is that we have an extension of surveillance to the whole population. Effectively, everyone is seen as potentially somehow dangerous, and that we all need to be under some form of surveillance. The younger generation, who I've now succumbed to one of these phones like a BlackBerry thing, which I can't work and it's so difficult. But that's a very effective tool of surveillance, because through these machines, eventually the whole population is under surveillance. They know where we are, where we're moving around, who we're talking to, all of this, and it's creating, in effect. It's creating what Tony Bunyan calls a haystack of information, in which the real information, if the state really wanted to find a terrorist, is being hidden, because they're so distracted by all the bogeymen that they've created, all the scare stories that possibly somebody might be thinking something, somebody else might be talking to the wrong sort of person. That in fact the real people who are the real dangers, who are really going to hurt members of any human beings, are not being identified or found, because they've just created this mass of information about everybody. And one of the main interests in pursuing this security agenda, of course, are the commercial interests, the military complex, the people who stand to make profit out of selling biometric scanning machines, border control equipment, infrared guns, infrared spy technology. So all of that has become an industry in itself. And the more we buy into this notion that migration somehow is something to be feared, I mean, the more that we're underwriting, really, you know, the profits of these military, industrial, security complexes. So what would be very healthy is to have the word migration taken out of the English or any other vocabulary, and we just think about human mobility as one aspect of what we do, what we happen to do, like eating a meal, or, you know, being a migrant is just part of being a human being. So let's take the word out of vocabulary and somehow get out of this kind of corner that we've been painting ourselves into by using that term and taking the state on its own agenda, really. So I think I'll finish there, and I've got loads more to say, but perhaps we could open up a discussion for 20 minutes.